This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in British Studies. I'm your host, Christina Fryer. Today we're speaking with Kennetta Hammond-Perry, author of the new book, London is the Place for Me, Black Britons, Citizenship, and the Politics of Race, published by Oxford University Press in 2015. London is the Place for Me is a... Welcome to New Books in British Studies. I'm your host, Christina Fryer. Today we're speaking with Kennetta Hammond-Perry, author of the new book, London is the Place for Me, Black Britons, Citizenship, and the Politics of Race, published by Oxford University Press in 2015. London is the Place for Me is a political history of post-war Caribbean migration to Britain between the late 1940s and the early 1960s. Perry is particularly interested in the politics of claim-making, as practiced by Black Caribbean migrants, who arrived in London as British citizens claiming their right to live and work in the metropole. For them, migration itself was a practice of citizenship. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hi, everyone, and welcome to New Books in British Studies. I'm your host, Christina Fryer, and today I'm here with Kennetta Hammond-Perry, author of the very new book, so new it is crispy, these pages, London is the Place for Me. I should say before we even start this interview, this particular book is very personal to me since my mother and my grandparents were part of the phenomenon that we'll be talking about. So I am very excited, Kennetta, to be speaking with you today. So welcome to New Books in British Studies.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we'll start with the general questions that we always ask here. What led you to become a historian?
Well, I think I was always interested in history. I started my undergraduate work at North Carolina Central, and I thought I was going to law school and sort of ended up in history and sort of, still thinking about law school. But that department in particular just has a long history of really getting students to think seriously about becoming professional historians. So we were sort of, I was sort of socialized in a history department as an undergraduate that took students to conferences, sort of exposed them to the research side of being an academic during that period. And then I also had the opportunity to be a part of what at the time was called the Minority Undergraduate Research Apprenticeship Program at UNC Chapel Hill. And that was just really formative in terms of, giving me a research experience to really sort of, develop my chops as a historian as an undergraduate. And it was sort of that kind of cemented the idea of going on to graduate school and pursuing a PhD in history. So I sort of always was interested in history, and in particular sort of the sort of classic era of the civil rights movement, and sort of took that on and was really nurtured in an undergraduate department that kind of allowed me to think about, you know, what it would mean to do that professionally and to really go into a career in academia.
So then if you were so interested in the civil rights movement in particular, how did you come to this project, which is all about not the U.S. civil rights movement, but about almost a contemporaneous movement in Britain? How'd you end up there?
It's really that kind of interest that started the project. I went to graduate school really thinking that I was going to do work primarily in African-American women's history and sort of looking at the 1950s, 1960s, looking at grassroots organizers. And I went to graduate school at Michigan State in a comparative Black history program. And one of the seminars that I took with my dissertation advisor, Darlene Clark Hine, was this comparative Black history seminar where you essentially the key project at the end of the semester was all about putting together a project where you were sort of looking at Blackness and issues around race and Black identities here and there. And so the project really came from this question of sort of trying to, you know, ask about like, well, what was it like for Black people in Britain during the 1950s and 1960s, an era I was already interested in terms of Black freedom struggles in the U.S. And it was really sort of, you know, finding these incidents of the sort of race riots, news of race riots that I write about in the book, and sort of also really sort of finding the international reverberations of African-American freedom struggles and sort of the iconography of the civil rights movement in this context that kind of really spurred me to kind of stay there and to see what was going on and to figure out, okay, well, what is this sort of, you know, what is constituting Black community there? And then, you know, sort of really finding these connections between struggles in the U.S. and sort of understanding those connections that kind of kept me invested in that project. And so I kind of switched gears and stayed in the U.K. But, you know, it definitely was this kind of very U.S. oriented question that led me to the U.K.
That's fascinating. So what's come out of this interest that you developed in that graduate seminar is a political history of the first two decades of mass migration. And I'm using the term migration very specifically as opposed to immigration. So the first two decades of mass migration of colonial subjects or probably better known as Commonwealth citizens to Britain, and this began in 1948. Now, this is territory that has been semi-well covered by historians, but you were bringing a different approach to this particular time period. Can you tell us what your approach is and why you felt it was important to come at this study in this fashion?
Well, I think, you know, one of the central points that I wanted to try to do in terms of, you know, making an intervention in the scholarship and there is sort of a rich scholarship that has evolved that sort of looked at questions of race, migration, and oftentimes really immigration and citizenship, particularly from the perspective of policymakers and sort of looked at the politics surrounding those three concepts, particularly in the moment that I'm looking at from the perspective of policymakers. And so one of the key things that I wanted to do is to really, you know, think about this history and think about the politics of race and citizenship from the perspective of those who were quite often the objects of scrutiny or the objects of anxiety in terms of how policymakers were thinking about things. So I really wanted to create a narrative that really pivoted on the experiences of Afro-Caribbean migrants. And so as a condition of that and really sort of shifting the lens, it became impossible not to tell this story in terms of its relationship to sort of a larger transnational moment around race politics that was sort of connecting the politics of race as viewed from the perspective of Afro-Caribbean migrants to other Black freedom struggles, particularly in the United States, in South Africa, to decolonization movements in the Caribbean, and in parts of Asia during late 1940s up through the early 1960s. So it was really by necessity that the story had to become this story that was bigger than a story that could be contained within the British Isles, or could be that, you know, wasn't just a domestic story when you kind of put, Afro-Caribbean migrants and their activism at the center of scholarly investigation. And so that, really trying to focus on Afro-Caribbean migrants and the politics that they are engendering in this moment, and really trying to understand that moment, both in terms of a longer history of empire, but also in terms of a post-war story about transnational race politics. Those are sort of, I think, I'm hoping, the greatest interventions in the scholarship that I hope the project's making.
And certainly, I think the use of a context of diaspora politics and transnational race politics comes across very clearly, and we will get back to that as we proceed. So you open with the Empire Windrush, and you also open with with London Is the Place for Me, which is a calypso song that furnishes the title for the text. For listeners who might not know, can you tell us about what the Empire Windrush was, why it's so significant in the literature, and then we can pivot to Lord Kitchener and London Is the Place for Me.
Well, the Empire Windrush was sort of this very iconic arrival of, the Empire Windrush quite literally was a warship, a battleship, and it was the ship that sort of gets a lot of media attention, in particular because of its arrival in June of 1948, and it brings, over 500 Afro-Caribbean migrants. The number that sort of oftentimes stated over and over again is 492, but actually, if you sort of look at the ship's manifest, the numbers were actually higher than that. And it also wasn't just a ship that contained was bringing Afro-Caribbean migrants, but it also contained Polish migrants. I also found that British heiress Nancy Kennard was aboard the Empire Windrush, who's a sort of, interesting figure in her own right, particularly in relation to a lot of the issues that are central to the project. So, but I think what's, has become historically significant about, or the way that it's been talked about in terms of its historical significance, I think, revolved around the media attention that it got, and particularly, that iconic performance that Lord Kitchener gives of London Is the Place for Me, and the ways in which that particular arrival creates a type of news story about the arrival of migrants from the Caribbean, and in particular, male migrants from the Caribbean. And that in some ways sort of that news story that sort of set in motion with the visuals that come along with, having that arrival being recorded at Tilbury Docks and being sort of presented as part of this this media narrative, becomes sort of the ways in which it becomes kind of the launching pad by which historians had sort of talked about the significance of Afro-Caribbean migration in the post-World War II period. So in many ways, it is popularly very significant in terms of, connecting the story of Afro-Caribbean migration in following World War II to sort of a larger development of post-colonial Black Britain. So it's been very significant in that regard. So I wanted to return to it, but sort of think about it differently in the book.
And you mentioned that that there are a number of different ways that the Windrush has been described in the literature. Can you walk us through some of those?
Well, in particular, I think probably the overarching way that it's been described is sort of this kind of point of origin, this point of origin for sort of understanding contemporary Black Britain, and sort of understanding Afro-Caribbean, centering Afro-Caribbean migration, post-World War II Afro-Caribbean migration. As a part of that, it's also sort of, and sort of as part of that origin story, it kind of takes us away from having a sense that there were, in fact, for generations settled Black communities in the UK that sort of form our sense of what we can imagine Black Britain's multiple histories to be. And so, you know, that's sort of one of the biggest, I think, issues that scholars have taken. I think, you know, there's definitely been a critique of that. But just that it is this sort of point of origin has been sort of the biggest piece that, in terms of understanding that Windrush moment, that it is the moment, this sort of originary moment where we should begin to talk about Afro-Caribbean migration and more significantly to talk about contemporary Black Britain.
So let's briefly chat about London is the Place for Me, the Calypso song, because you use this as a way to talk about how Afro-Caribbean migrants saw themselves as belonging in Britain, in London, in this particular song, but also in Britain more broadly, that they belonged there and that they were basically owed a place there. Can you talk about that?
Well, I mean, one of the things I definitely wanted to do in terms of trying to rethink the Windrush moment and really think about it as in relation to the politics of that moment is to really think about London is the Place for Me, not just as a performance that was something that made news or to help script a type of news story about the arrival of Afro-Caribbean migrants, but to really think about that as a moment of claim making and sort of really thinking about the use of Calypso in particular as a, you know, in the politics surrounding Calypso as a type of musical genre and its meaning historically within the context of empire in the Caribbean. But also just the words themselves and the fact that, you know, Lord Kitchener arrives with this sense. That's a huge piece that he arrives with this sense of being able to make this claim that London could be the place for him. London could be this place where he and you know, likely his fellow Windrush compatriots from the Caribbean could be this place where he could belong. And that it doesn't take, you know, literally being in the British Isles or actually, you know, going through the process of settlement, but they can arrive making this claim. And so it's precisely not only the claim itself and thinking about that as sort of a claim on belonging, a claim of being a part of a type of imperial body politic. But also I think the fact that, again, that he arrives with this claim and that sort of points us back to sort of thinking about, well, how then, you know, is he able to sort of already arrive in the UK with this sense that this is a place that he could belong rightfully? And so that's where, you know, in my view, it opens us up to having to sort of necessitate a conversation about, well, you know, again, how do people arrive with this sense of already being able to make this claim? It's not a claim that's forged in the context of being in Britain, but it's a claim that's already there before they arrive. And so that's sort of what took me back to trying to sort of think about the genealogies of those claims within the context of the imperial post-emancipation Caribbean.
So this actually is a perfect transition into chapter one. And as you've been describing, one of the key arguments of the book is that migration itself was a form of claim making. And in particular, the insistence that colonial subjects were British citizens. And part of that, the last part of that, the fact that they were British citizens comes up in the 20th century. But in chapter one, you are tracing these claims back to the post-emancipation period, which happens to be one of my favorite periods in Caribbean history. So can you explain, or walk us through the arguments that you're making in chapter one, and what you actually found in the post-emancipation period about the kinds of claims, that free people were beginning to make?
I definitely would like to say, you know, I don't think that chapter one is meant to be sort of an exhaustive treatment of this issue of claim making. I think what I really wanted to do in the in that first chapter was to, again, just to sort of present, to sort of try to stitch together a narrative that sort of allows us to connect these discourses around rights, these discourses of British identifications that sort of don't see blackness, ideas about blackness, ideas about coloniality, ideas about about Britishness being these sort of mutually exclusive categories, mm-hmm. but that they are these categories that can be simultaneously held together and can be these categories that when held simultaneously together can sort of create this kind of, structure to advocate for rights, structure to make claims upon rights, within the empire and within the context of notions of citizenship. So part of what I wanted to do in that chapter was again to both see how people of African descent were sort of doing that as part of the very process by which they're making claims about freedom, they're making claims about subjecthood well before we see the arrival of Afro-Caribbean migrants in more significant numbers in the post-World War II period. So it's really to try to give an imperial backdrop for sort of understanding notions of what, you know, become more clear as notions of Black Britishness in the metropole in the post-World War II period, but to really kind of see them historically as this is essentially something that's not new. This is something that people have arrived with a sense that these things are not incongruent with one another, ideas about Blackness and ideas about Britishness. And so in that chapter, you know, part of what I really try to do is to begin by sort of just thinking about the early history of abolitionism and the ways in which abolition as a process, as a historical process, creates these types of discourses of belonging that are all about sort of trying to figure out the place of the formerly enslaved within the context of empire.
Right.
And that's something that's being done by, you know, folks who are involved in formal anti-slavery societies, as well as sort of insurgents in Demerara in 1823, who are also making claims about their rights and making claims about what the meaning of freedom will be, and that it will confer this sense of rights and this sense of belonging within the context of imperial subjecthood. And so I sort of begin there and try to sort of think through the early years of abolition and emancipation, the process of abolition and the early years of emancipation. I also try to sort of look briefly at sort of how these same ideas are carried forth in some of 19th century Black nationalist thought, and paying attention to the ways in which individuals who are quite frankly writing very explicitly about conditions of Blackness in the Caribbean see no disconnect between also advocating about their rights around this language of being subjects of the empire and these ideas of Britishness, and also quite frankly questioning the empire and sort of contesting you know, colonial authority on the grounds of having these rights that they can sort of make claims to by being within the context of the empire and being connected to this sense of subjecthood. And then, you know, the other sort of piece that I try to do in that chapter is to kind of pay attention to kind of sort of the everyday vernaculars of this belonging and these notions of what will sort of become more clear as notions of belonging and citizenship and sort of the claiming of rights, even through ritualistic practices like around mourning Queen Victoria or Empire Day, and sort of really trying to sort of think about the ways in which, you know, people sort of selected that kind of culture of empire to make political claims, even in the Caribbean. And these are the same types of things that you'll see happen in the imperial metropolis in the post-World War II period. So I really wanted to sort of connect this history of claim making to the Caribbean and really try to see some of the Caribbean angles of Black Britishness even before it's called that more clearly in the post-World War II period or in the latter half of the 20th century.
Right. And I think there's a particularly interesting way that these claims of belonging are sort of mobilized against colonial authorities and to some degree the imperial authorities in the form of, say, the colonial office or whatnot. But that the queen or the monarchy sort of remains this sort of specter of pure liberalism and pure benevolence. And I think as we move into some of the later chapters, that idea that British imperialism or Britishness is inherently good and inherently anti-racist, we will come back to that later. So if we move into chapter two, we have a sense that from the post-emancipation period onward, Afro-Caribbeans have been mobilizing the language of belonging in certain ways. And this, how do I want to phrase this? It basically moves into higher gear, I think, with the 1948 British Nationality Act that confers a new set of rights that seems to transform subjecthood into citizenship. Can you talk to us about the 1948 British Nationality Act and why it was so important for your work?
Well, I mean, you know, the British Nationality Act of 1948 is important because in some ways it really formally introduces this language of citizenship. And as your question quite rightly notes, in some ways it becomes a way to talk about what has been this kind of imperial subjecthood, but in these terms of citizenship, and in particular Commonwealth citizenship, which then opens this new category of British citizenship or citizenship of the United Kingdom and colonies. But what's interesting about, I think, the British Nationality Act, it is really a response in some ways to, in many ways rather, to Dominion nationalism, in particular, shifting policies, nationality policies, in particular, a new development in terms of Canadian nationality policy that happens in 1946. And it's really a response to the ways in which nations within the Commonwealth are now beginning to sort of assert their sense of nationality outside of sort of the dominant notion of subjecthood. And so the Canadian nationality policy sort of reverses the relationship formally between subjecthood and local nationality by sort of saying one becomes a British subject or Commonwealth citizen by way of first being a Canadian national. Whereas before, you know, the assumption would have been that everyone in the Commonwealth or everyone within that would have automatically sort of been British subjecthood would have been available regardless, but it's the local nationality that then takes precedent over one's relationship to the empire or the empire Commonwealth. And so it's precisely in terms of the ways in which the dominions are now defining new ways of marking their local nationalities within the context of Commonwealth that you then see the UK itself have to sort of rethink its own notions about local citizenship status. And so, again, you have this category of citizen of the United Kingdom and colonies, which really essentially creates a local citizenship status that is actually shared between metropole and colony at this particular moment. So, you know, it's a really significant act in terms of shifting the political lexicon around sort of formal citizenship and its meaning within the context of the British Empire and Commonwealth. But also at the same time, in chapter two, I also want to also, you know, really show that even though this is the 1948 is when we see it enter into official political discourse, this has been a vernacular discourse that people within the empire have well understood themselves and made claims through well before it becomes this type of formal language by 1948.
Now, did White Britons understand what the 1948 Nationality Act entailed, or what it meant for the rights of migrants of colonial migrants to be there?
Well, I think, I mean, part of the way that I, you know, approach it in the book is sort of looking at the ways and looking at the parliamentary debate in particular. And so my conversation around how it was interpreted particularly among white Britons. And the metropole is kind of limited to this understanding of how policymakers were talking about the implications of this policy. Sure. And they definitely were thinking about it within the context of it being a type of nationality policy and not necessarily a nationality policy that was going to have implications as it related to migration. And so, the debate in Parliament about the British Nationality Act in particular is all about, this debate about sort of, creating these types of hierarchies in terms of how, the metropole was going to regard these different communities within the Commonwealth, like whether or not, someone from Jamaica was going to in fact have a different, relationship to Britain, than someone from one of the dominions from Australia. So there was all this debate, this very racially coded debate about sort of the hierarchies of belonging within the context of the empire and Commonwealth. And there was very little, interestingly, there's very little consideration of the ways in which, nationality policy, was going to function as a type of, was going to really continue to function as a type of migration policy. And so it's interesting that the debate is all about sort of these questions around race and nationality in terms of its passage in Parliament and the debates about its significance there. But it ends up having much more significance in terms of what it allows in terms of migration policy. And it's not necessarily a shift. There's always been throughout the 20th century, rights of migration in terms of imperial subjects throughout the empire in the 20th century. Now, however, I do talk about, there were definitely moments where, there were ways in which there were policies put in place trying to sort of limit, in particular, non-white migration from the empire. But this right of migration to Britain had always been there. But that was the piece of the 1948 nationality policy that actually becomes most important in terms of the politics of race and migration.
Right. So in the wake of the 1948 British Nationality Act, we have, of course, the Empire Windrush. And then, as I understand it, there's actually a bit of a lull in between the Empire Windrush and the sort of large waves of Caribbean migration that really are driven by a piece of legislation in the U.S., the McCarran-Walter Act. Briefly, the McCarran-Walter Act limits the amount of Caribbean migration into the U.S., which basically forces anybody who wants to migrate. The U.K. is now the obvious place. So by the mid-1950s, we're talking about a fair number of Caribbean migrants who are moving to the U.K., who are settling there. Can you talk to us about their early experiences, especially the ways that they try to present themselves as citizens?
Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely right in terms of it's really the mid 1950s that you really begin to see more significant numbers of Afro-Caribbean migrants, and so that's one of the other. It sort of leads back to your other question. One of the other issues with the Empire Windrush is that it wasn't even that this was the moment, even if you were going to make it a type of moment demographically. It's not that there's the Windrush and then, year by year that we see this incremental increase in the numbers of Afro-Caribbean migrants that are coming to the UK. So it's definitely the mid-1950s. And essentially, in those early years of migration, the settlement experiences, I think probably the two biggest issues are issues of employment and issues of housing.
Right.
That sort of become part of or mark kind of the everyday politics of settlement, and that are these very sort of racialized politics of settlement, or mark the racialized politics of settlement there. One of the interesting things to note is that, in addition to the U.S. becoming this place that is no longer as easily navigable in terms of border crossing, but also the U.K. becomes, a place that one could think about migrating, particularly because there are these post-war labor shortages that are very much advertised, and there's a reality of a post-war labor shortage, particularly beginning in the late 1940s and throughout the 1950s. But it's a particular kind of labor shortage that's sort of limited to sort of the lower paying segments of the economy, very entry level positions. And so these are going to be the positions where there really are going to be more job openings, and there are going to be more opportunities for Afro-Caribbean migrants to sort of find a place in the labor market, despite the fact that people might be migrating with more credentials, more experience, more education, to sort of place them in a different bracket in the labor market. They're going to find, in particular, that they're going to that more jobs, the availability, the ability to find work is going to be at the lower rung of the labor market. And then also the issue of housing is definitely going to be something that's going to mark the experience of settlement. And that's has to sort of be their difficulties in terms of finding housing has to be read within the backdrop of sort of a larger post-war housing shortage. You know, you're still, you know, less than a decade out of the end of World War II. And so Britain as a whole domestically is still very much in the process of rebuilding the nation, quite literally. And so this creates a number of issues as it relates to housing for Afro-Caribbean migrants. And then, you know, overall, I think just there's sort of the issues of settlement also have to sort of be seen in relation to the earliest years of just the welfare state and sort of, you know, sort of finding your way within the welfare state in and of itself is sort of it's sort of in the making at this particular moment. So these issues are definitely being being navigated within the backdrop of that. And in some ways, I think one can think about, you know, the issue of the welfare state being sort of this kind of looming thing that people their access to the resources of the welfare state and their stake in society is also being, is part of the ways in which people, you know, I think is probably impacting the politics that are being shaped in this moment.
So, can you talk about the photographs?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I love those.
That was, you know, they definitely sort of made this project come alive for me. You know, really, you know, I there was a collection of photographs and I wanted to include more, but there were permission issues and all sorts of,
right.
of things that sort of got in the way of that. But some of the first photographs that I came across that were just sort of, you know, every, you know, depictions of everyday life, family photographs came from the Harry Jacobs collection out of the Lambeth Libraries. And Harry Jacobs was a Jewish photographer that was sort of the person to go to in Brixton. He actually sort of made many of the newly settled Afro-Caribbean communities in that area his base. That's where he sort of marketed to and sort of was his bread and butter. In the 1950s and 1960s, and he donated his collections to the Lambeth Archives, and he really has a very amazing collection of photographs of people and their family photographs. And in particular, I think the family photographs are interesting to think about, particularly when juxtaposed with the ways in which images worked in the media to sort of create this narrative around the color problem of right. Afro-Caribbean migrants. And these family photographs in particular do, I think, a very significant political work in terms of really challenging that narrative and contesting that narrative and reframing images of Afro-Caribbean migrants within the context of family that challenge the narrative of a color problem that's masculine and sort of embodied by the presence of single Black men who are going to sort of create this sexual threat, who are going to sort of be these sort of transient individuals who are not going to sort of be able to settle in any kind of respectable fashion. And these images, quite frankly, disrupt all of those sort of popular conceptions. And so in my view, and part of the reason why I present them in the book is because I do think they are very much part of an everyday type of politics of citizenship, a politics of belonging, a politics of representation, in terms of, showing how people wanted to be seen and how people, wanted to or imagine, their aspirations, you know, in British society and their sense of actually being settled, in Britain. And so the photographs are just important for all sorts of reasons. Photographs, you know, remind us again that these are migrating individuals. These are the types of artifacts that are going to connect them to the Caribbean and connect them to other parts of Caribbean diasporas, in different parts of the world. So these photographs are very, were very important to the project and a very important window for me and for my view into, to having a sense of how people saw themselves.
Right.
And wanted to.
And as I said at the top, this particular work is particularly personal to me. I have some of these photographs lurking in my family. I don't think it's by the same photographer, though I certainly will now check, because my family was basically based in North London, but certainly functioning in very similar ways of showing domestic happiness, marriage, and basically, again, completely disrupting this idea that these migrants are mainly Black transient men who are going to be a threat. So I particularly love that section, wanted to make sure that we talked about it. So from here forward, the remaining four chapters, they're basically sort of all focusing on a series of events. We can start with the first one, which is the famous 1958 Notting Hill riots. And in particular, you are using these riots to talk about a concept that I really love in the book, which is the mystique of Black anti-racism. Please explain the mystique of Black anti-racism.
The mystique of British anti-racism.
Oh, sorry. Yes. The mystique of British. That is a critical clarification. The mystique of British anti-racism. Mm-hmm.
So this was a term for me that was my way of trying to capture this sense and try to capture it and then work around it. This sense of representations of Britishness and British nationality, both domestically and also in the world, and sort of what I settle on in terms of this notion of a mystique of British anti-racism, particularly in the post-war War II period, is the ways in which it sort of congeals around really historic post-abolitionist narratives of Britain as being benevolent, Britain as being tolerant, Britain as being anti-racist, particularly in relation to the U.S. and South Africa in the post-World War II period, Britain being this place that is the mother country of a type of multiracial commonwealth. And that's where the 1948 British Nationality Act is one of those policies that kind of allows you to tout this sense that, you know, commonwealth citizenship is sort of bringing, you know, all of these races and nations and these different diverse populations of the empire under the banner of commonwealth citizenship and this idea of Britishness. And, you know, part of what I wanted to do with the mystique of British anti-racism is to both mark it, but also think about how it elides a way of even sort of thinking about the history of race politics in the UK and more precisely histories of racism in the UK. But also sort of thinking about how it is something that is both touted in terms of what the nation is, but it's also something that I think Black activists on the ground summon the nation to be. And really sort of, you know, they are also saying, you know, at the same time that the nation, they're very, you know, I think some of the activists that I'm concerned with are very aware of the way in which the nation wants to represent itself in these very sort of liberal terms as anti-racist, as multiracial, as sort of promoting these ideas of racial democracy, particularly after having sort of fought a war in the name of some of these very same values. And so, At the same time that I think the news about race riots sort of calls into question this image of Britain as sort of this liberal, tolerant, anti-racist nation, it also is the very thing that Black activists sort of call the nation to be and sort of use it as a way to sort of call the nation out in terms of the racial conditions that Black people are facing on the street. During the same particular period. So, you know, part of what I wanted to do was to really sort of think about that idea of Britain as a nation historically, but also how it works within the context of race politics in that post-World War II period.
And you also highlight the way that in response to the riots, the British government, let's say, and certainly please be more specific if necessary, we're also trying to preserve that mystique. So their response to, if not the riots, certainly the international outcry about the riots shows them really concerned about preserving this image. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. I think, you know, and definitely sort of trying to explain the news of race riots and the ways that it's circulating internationally was very interesting to see in like the different segments of government, particularly like the Commonwealth Relations Office and the Colonial Office, sort of summoning their diplomats in different regions of the world to try to sort of manage the image of the nation that's being reported in the press around the world. And you sort of definitely see that in some of the diplomatic correspondence is coming out of those different branches of government. And part of the narrative that is actually fed to the diplomats, which the diplomats are in theory have this responsibility of trying to sort of influence international press opinion about in their different local outposts, is creating this narrative about sort of the problem of an increasing West Indian migrant population, but also sort of creating a type of blame for, you know, this outburst of racial violence in British cities like London and like Nottingham, and sort of creating this blame that centers on the character of the Teddy Boy, who is this individual who sort of represents a kind of deviant youth, working class masculinity that is sort of a product of a particular region, a specific area, a specific kind of working class, urban, depraved life. And so that's those are kind of the two images that kind of or two narratives that kind of come out of how you see diplomats sort of beginning to try to different segments of the British government in terms of how they're trying to communicate a message about the meaning of these episodes of racial violence that centers upon the problem of Caribbean migration, and maybe that this can be something that can be solved because, you know, if we can just sort of think about border control, but also you should know that this is not something that's representative of the nation, but it's sort of this very, you know, problematic, deviant sector of society. And so those are part of the ways in which there's an effort to try to really, what I argue, preserve this kind of mystique, because if you can make it all about the problem of the presence of single Black men from the Caribbean who sort of are, you know, represent, you know, a type of problem population, and then you can make the reaction to that migration this sort of very deviant outcast segment of society, you can still, you know, present this narrative that this is not something that is representative of the values of the nation as a whole. And so part of what I want to do, I try to do in that chapter, is to sort of show how even, you know, at the level of the state, you see these conversations, and you actually see the narrative being created around, you know, restoring law and order from these deviant individuals who sort of gotten out of hand. That becomes the narrative that's coming from the prime minister and also being circulated amongst the diplomats internationally, but also you sort of see that in, you know, everyday press reporting, that narrative gets sort of taken up over and over again, that this violence can sort of be explained as a product of, you know, increasing Black migration, or an increasing Black population in London and Nottingham. And also that it's the product of these activities of kind of a lunatic fringe, or these sort of Teddy Boy rowdies.
Right, right. And we move from the riots to yet another. I mean, this idea, this racial violence continues. And in chapter four, you're focusing on the murder of Kelso Cochran, and the way that his death sort of sparks, if not a new form, a more vigorous form of Black advocacy, one that parallels or one that draws attention to the parallel between Jim Crow violence and what's happening in Britain. So can you talk about this in particular? I think now would be a good time to talk about Claudia Jones as well.
Yeah, Kelso Cochran, and I definitely think you phrase it correctly, is the murder of Kelso Cochran is not necessarily to sort of say that there was no political activity at all to speak of in the 1950s, but it's definitely a moment where you definitely see more visible Black political activity in regards to protest around his murder and really politicizing his murder as something that is representative of a larger trend of violence against people of African descent, and in particular, largely Afro-Caribbean migrant population. And and Claudia Jones in particular is one of the key figures that's a part of the organizing that happens in the aftermath of his murder. She's actually in the run up in the year before the murder, in the year, the time between the news of race riots in Notting Hill and Kelso Cochran's death. Claudia Jones, during that same period of time, founds the West Indian Gazette newspaper, which is really going to be sort of a centerpiece of an emerging Black British political culture in the 1950s and early 1960s. She's also involved in a number of grassroots organizations, some of which she's involved with Amy Ashwood Garvey. Those two kind of overlap a lot in terms of some of the local organizations that they're involved in the late 1950s and 1960s. But those, Claudia Jones and her activism in organizations like the Association for the Advancement of Colored People and the Interracial Friendship Coordinating Council are going to be some of the key organizations that get involved in, the funding, the legal defense of those who were involved in the violence in Nottingham and in Notting Hill, and also organizing the burial plans and arranging for a public memorial service for Kelso Cochran. And she is an individual that definitely is sort of at the core, linking a number of different organizations that are involved in domestic politics, but also making the link between domestic politics and domestic race politics in the UK, and connections between decolonization and efforts to sort of support the West Indies Federation, which is something that's on the table at the time, and also making connections between apartheid in South Africa and Afro-Asian solidarities around the oppression of colonial subjects more globally. So Claudia Jones is someone who really helps to make the link in really concrete in specific ways between local politics on the ground involving Afro-Caribbean migrants and Black British communities, and really making those links between global and diasporic race politics.
And you note in this chapter, and I think this is a good way to segue into the final section of the book, that part of this activism around Kelso Cochran is insisting that that Black Britons are citizens, subjects / citizens, and that they are not immigrants. And we see when we move into chapters 5 and 6, which talk about two pieces of legislation, that this distinction between immigrants and citizens comes to the fore in the form of legislation. So let's take the first, what's in Chapter 5, the 1962 Commonwealth Immigration Act. This is another site of activism, as you point out. Why is this act challenged so vigorously?
Well, part of, and again, many of the coalitions that form in protest to the Commonwealth Immigration Act, or what becomes the Commonwealth Immigration Act of 1962, are organizations that come out of response to the murder of Kelso Cochran. So some of those key coalitions are formed in that moment. But the Commonwealth Immigration Act of 1962 is an act that essentially on its face is all about regulating migration from the Commonwealth to the UK on the grounds of one's relationship to the labor market. But at the end of the day, migrants like, you know, folks like Claudia Jones and activists who are have taken very serious issue with the Commonwealth Immigration Act, look at it as a type of policy that's going to disproportionately affect and disproportionately deny the right to migrate to Britain to a largely non-white Commonwealth community. And at that time, still at the time the act is passed, is dominated by Afro-Caribbean migrants. And so Claudia Jones in particular is someone who takes to task both the way in which the implications of the Commonwealth Immigration Act of 1962 sort of strip away a sort of foundational right of citizenship, that being that right to migrate to the UK as part of being a citizen of the United Kingdom and colonies and being a Commonwealth citizen under the terms of the British Nationality Act. So it strips and makes distinctions between those who are resident in the metropole and those who are in the Commonwealth and colonies. But also one of the interesting arguments that Claudia Jones makes, which I think is very much informed by her experience being an immigrant in the context of the United States and being a deportable subject, as Carol Boyce Davies has talked about. She talks about what this immigration policy that has these nationality implications, but what this immigration policy will mean, particularly even for those individuals who have crossed the borders, who are citizens in the context of the metropole. And I think, you know, she is one of those individuals that makes the most pointed critique for what the ways in which the creation of a legal category of immigrant in the sense that, you know, immigrant being a type of person who is deportable, a citizen. That's one of the things that marks an immigrant from a citizen in that, you know, a citizen can't be deported in the same way that an immigrant essentially can. But in creating this idea of legally creating an apparatus for the ways in which Commonwealth citizens can now be immigrants and can be these deportable subjects, that it's going to infringe upon the citizenship rights of those who are potentially going to migrate, but also those who are already in the UK. And she makes, you know, one of the key arguments that she makes in terms of her organizing and one of the points that the one of the organizations that she's involved with that's protesting this act is they look at one of the subsections that basically empowers immigration officials to question and surveil the properties of landlords who may be renting to and creates penalties for those who are found guilty of renting property to someone who has violated the provisions of the Commonwealth Immigration Act. And so she harps on that to sort of talk about the ways in which that creates these conditions for surveillance, disincentivizes already dire accommodation, it disincentivizes people from migrating, from renting to people who could be under that sort of racialized category of immigrant. And so, you know, she really is someone who organizes and really articulates this vision of what this legal apparatus for creating the category of immigrant means for both those who want to cross the borders, but also want to actually reside and remain as citizens and continue to make claims of belonging who are already resident in the UK.
So if I could make or just clarify something, both for my purposes and listeners' purposes, the Commonwealth Immigration Act does not formally strip Commonwealth subjects of citizenship. Is that correct?
So no, I mean, it does not, it strips them of their right to migrate on the basis of being Commonwealth citizens alone.
Okay. So it strips them of British citizenship, but continues to have, continues to confer a Commonwealth citizenship that basically is meaningless for these purposes.
Well, the British citizenship and the Commonwealth citizenship are still going to be there, but okay, in practice, it's still going to regulate who can access the rights attached to those two categories of citizenship, which are essentially one and the same, mm-hmm. for those who are going to be migrating from the colonies and different parts of the Commonwealth. So it's not that it sort of strips in name their citizenship, okay, but ability to sort of exercise certain rights, as it is attached to that citizenship becomes conditioned upon where you are living in the Commonwealth.
Right.
And essentially, I think the other thing, the disenfranchising parts of that, is it does create conditions for deportability,
yes,
for people who have not been resident in the UK for 5 years or more.
Okay. And that, I mean, that's actually really fascinating, because it also suggests that there's now a creation of a British citizenship that does not give you the right to live in Britain.
Yes.
Okay.
Or does not give you the right to remain without condition. So like if you were to create commit a crime or something, you know, you could be deported.
Okay.
And I think that's sort of one of the big pieces.
And I just want, we won't go into it, but I do want to flag for listeners the very fascinating case of Carmen Bryan, who really illustrates again this what now has become a possibility to deport people who were previously citizens who could not be deported, because as you note, citizenship generally means that one cannot be deported. So we have this piece of legislation, 1962 Commonwealth Immigration Act, which was a piece of legislation, correct me if I'm wrong, that was from the Conservative Party?
Yes.
Okay. And Labour is sort of questioning it, that you note that they are in opposition to it. But by the time we get to 1965, with the Race Relations Act, the subject of Chapter 6, Labour is in power. They have basically taken the Conservative position on immigration. They're happy to continue those immigration controls and much more stringent immigration controls. And yet, to sort of save face in certain ways, they finally admit that there is a race relations problem in Britain, and they do so through the putting forth of a Race Relations Act. Can you talk to us about what the Race Relations Act was supposed to do, and then once again the outpouring of Black activism against it?
You're absolutely right in terms of, looking at 1962 being this pivotal policy moment where you have the Conservative Party in power. And you do have, I try to talk about in the book that there is definitely the Labour Party. There's some staunch Labour Party leaders who express opposition to this party and express it on the grounds of the racial politics of the policy in particular. One of the things that gets harped on by members of the Labour Party who speak out in opposition is the fact that this policy is not going to apply to Irish migrants from it's going to apply to a particular part of the Commonwealth. And so, that's one of the interesting pieces that comes out of Labour Party opposition and the ways that they sort of flag it as this very sort of racialized policy that's specifically meant to target non-white Commonwealth immigrants.
Okay.
The Commonwealth Immigration Act of 1962, and in particular, this issue of the ways in which the Labour Party, members of the Labour Party, very prominent members of the Labour Party, Hugh Gaitskill, who's the leader of the Labour Party at the time that the act is passed, do, object and oppose, speak out and object and oppose this policy on the grounds that in particular doesn't apply to Irish migrants. And in particular, that they use that as a case to talk about the ways in which this is meant to strip migration rights from a particular segment of the Commonwealth, particularly non-white Commonwealth migrants. But then the other piece that's sort of interesting in terms of how the Commonwealth Immigration Act ends up working is that in terms of the deportations, it's actually Irish migrants who are deported. The highest numbers of deportations that happen in Jordan and Balkan has a great article that sort of outlines the other half of the restrictions that come out of that particular policy and the racial politics around that, and how Irish migrants become sort of the highest numbers of deportees under that policy. But by 1965, you definitely have a Labor Party that has, changed in some ways. Hugh Gaitskill actually dies. And so, there is just a different Labor Party that's actually in power, and they have a different relationship to the politics of race, and also the politics of race as it is defined through these questions around migration and immigration policy. And by 1965, I think you definitely see a Labor Party who is trying to sort of neutralize the connections between race and immigration policy by just sort of, really in some ways embracing that 1962 has happened. This policy has been in effect, and in some ways part of the conditions of moving, in some ways being seen as moving forward on these questions around race relations by embracing the race relations policy. It's also tethered to really a tightening of immigration policy. And one of the things that I think is important to note about understanding the Labor Party's position is that those voices who were dissenting to the Commonwealth Immigration Act and making that dissent based on the ways in which this was going to be a racialized policy of disenfranchisement were actually very successful, in the sense that they actually create a narrative whereby race and immigration are always linked moving forward. So by the time you get to a Labor Party in 1965, that is in power in 1965, the sort of public and popular discourse around race and immigration is very much cemented. So they definitely, by 1965, with the Race Relations Act, in some ways, it can be seen as part of the Labor Party, not trying to sort of challenge the restrictions on Commonwealth immigration, and trying to sort of turn a corner on race politics by looking at anti-discrimination policy. And part of what that 1965 Race Relations Act does, it's very tepid in the sense that it sort of outlaws discrimination in public places, but it's very non-specific, very non-committal. And it also does, to some extent, regulate language, incendiatory language, that would be racially coded incendiary language. But it's very, very tepid and does not address, particularly for some of the activists that sort of come out against its lack of real teeth, and it really does not regulate anti-discrimination legislation, particularly in areas where non-white migrants are experiencing some of the most virulent forms of everyday discrimination, particularly as it relates to housing and employment. And so that's part of the reason why you see an immediate response from organizations like the Campaign Against Racial Discrimination to try to really give some teeth to national anti-discrimination policy in the UK.
So the Campaign Against Racial Discrimination, otherwise known as CARD, this is the sort of final group that you focus on. And briefly, you note that they are sort of riven by internal tensions, and particularly internal tensions over exactly what strategy they should be using. And yet, I think you still are suggesting that they are successful. Can you explain how they're successful in certain ways, even though they disband relatively quickly?
Well, I think one of the legacies of CARD is that they are on the fore of really trying to make an empirical case for anti-discrimination policy in the mid-1960s. And there are other, there are definitely other organizations that sort of, become a part of this kind of race relations policy apparatus that's trying to sort of document the nature of racial discrimination and how the different arenas that it takes place in British society. But in some ways, CARD is really, I would argue, is really at the fore of that, even though in terms of the number of cases that they're documenting. There are other agencies that eventually go on to produce much larger studies. But in terms of presenting some of that early evidence to the Race Relations Board, which is actually another outcome of that first Race Relations Act that's passed in 1965, there's an establishment of a Race Relations Board that's supposed to be this national mediating body to sort of be this clearinghouse for hearing discrimination complaints. But again, the early problem with the Race Relations Board is that their purview is very limited in scope. They cannot hear these discrimination and sort of mediate discrimination cases in many of the areas that that people are experiencing racial discrimination on an everyday basis in the largest numbers. And so, like I said, CARD really, to me, I think they do have an important legacy in terms of really sort of adopting some of the strategies of civil rights organizations in the United States to really test policy and to really show the limits of policy by making an empirical case that discrimination is experienced in all of these different types of arenas and in all of these different ways. And so really trying to speak back to policymakers by making that empirical case is something that I think is really important about CARD. And they get a lot of media attention for sort of being that that national advocacy organization that is really comprised or representative of in particular Black and Asian migrant communities in that particular era, even if, you know, internally they have a lot going on. they definitely are able to create a national media profile that gives them the type of legs to get recognition in different official policy arenas there. So I think that they're really important, even though they are, you know, ultimately, you know, try to, I think, show that they're kind of the internal divisions between their strategies, but also the ways in which, you know, the constituencies in which they're going to represent, you know, they're very much, even from their very inception, sort of have a lot of debate about that, which I think prohibits the organization from being able to sustain itself.
Right. So by way of summing up, where do you think this all leaves us? Or what would you want the main takeaway for people to be after they finished reading the work?
Well, that's a great question. but I mean, I think at the end of the day, I really want to have presented a story where we really see, you know, Afro-Caribbean migrants in particular, but people of African descent making claims about Black Britishness and using that as a way to talk back to the state, to talk back to the state, to make claims about rights, to demand rights, to demand inclusion, both, you know, on the scale of the everyday, but also in relation to issues around settlement, whether it's housing, whether it's employment, whether it's having a sense of bodily security. One of the issues that I think what is really important about CARD is that they are part of one of the grassroots organizations in the 1960s that really advances a conversation about policing that becomes a really important narrative, particularly in the 1970s and 1980s in terms of Black Britons and their relationship to the state and the ways in which the state becomes complicit in the process by which they're deprived of their citizenship rights. And so part of what I want to do in this book is to really show that there is a much longer historical narrative for understanding many of these contemporary issues around Black Britons and their relationship to the state.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. The traditional final last question is, what are you working on now? Now that you have produced this amazing book, what are you working on now?
Well, I am starting a project that has kind of been sort of an outgrowth of this project. I'm looking at the case of the death of a Nigerian vagrant by the name of David Oluwole, whose body is pulled from the River Aire in Leeds in 1969, and it is actually his case is actually the first case where two police officers are actually convicted. They receive very short terms of imprisonment, but they're convicted of assault. And actually, they're tried initially for manslaughter. So they're actually tried for his death. But it's really one of the first cases where you begin to see a state agent in the form of a police officer actually be convicted of a crime that is happening against a Black person in custody. And so there are a number of organizations, particularly the Institute of Race Relations, which, again, has a very interesting post-war history that extends from the period that I look at in the book up through the present, that's sort of been tracking these instances of what they term Black deaths in custody. But I'm trying to sort of look at his case and look at the ways in which he gives us a completely different vantage point to kind of think about histories of contemporary Black Britain. He's Nigerian. He arrives as a stowaway. So he in 1949. So, you know, in this, you know, a year after Kitchener arrives to much fanfare, and we have this very different story around Afro-Caribbean migration. He immediately goes to prison when he arrives in the UK and sort of, you know, has a very different narrative, presents a very different narrative for unraveling some of the experiences of people of African descent in the UK in the post-World War II period. So I'm kind of following his case and trying to sort of think about what it tells us about state-sanctioned violence against Black Britons, particularly in the era before we get policing the crisis. So again, trying to really historicize some of what gets more traction in the 1980s and 1990s.
Well, that could not be more timely, given the particular moment that we're in. So we all look forward to reading that work. So Kanata, I'd like to thank you again for taking the time to speak with us today. We are so excited about the book, and I certainly hope that listeners take the time to read it as well. So thanks again, and bye.
You've been listening to New Books in British Studies. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time.